Under One Flag.
In cooperation with the Mutual Network, United Nations Radio presents a special transcribed feature broadcast on the organization that today is spotlighted in the world's news. What is the United Nations? What does it do? And how is it meeting the most serious challenge yet made to its authority as the guardian of world peace? Meeting it under one flag.
The Security Council, having determined that the armed attack upon the Republic of Korea by forces from North Korea constitutes a breach of the peace, have recommended that members of the United Nations furnish such assistance to the Republic of Korea as may be necessary to repel the armed attack and to restore international peace and security in the area, authorizes the Unified Command at its discretion to use the United Nations flag in the course of operations against North Korean forces concurrently with the flags of the various nations participating.
I count myself a reasonably well-informed citizen. I read the newspapers, and I try to keep myself informed on current affairs. That is, in the little time I can spare from managing my own affairs. But if anyone asked me to explain some of the outfits in the news these days, to define the functions of the UN Security Council, for instance, or to say how often the General Assembly meets, I'd be stumped for an answer. And I guess that what goes for me goes for most people.
Why bother, my friend? The big boys decide what's done. There's nothing you can do about it. This is just a war like any other war. Call it what you like.
A war like any other war. I wonder. That bit about the flag, for instance.
Authorizes the Unified Command at its discretion to use the United Nations flag in the course of operations against North Korean forces concurrently with the flags of the various nations participating.
You know, it struck me, listening to that, that this must be the first time armed forces have gone into action under an international flag. A new kind of flag.
A new kind of flag? Who wants a new kind of flag? A flag, something sacred, something you're prepared to die for. Like your own country, like your own people.
Freedom, shield, and hope. Other nations redeem their flags the best and cheer them with fervent elation. What the flag of the North and South and West is the flag of life, the flag of freedom's nation.
You see what I mean? There's something in a national flag a man can respond to. It's consecrated by the blood of the men who've died for it. But the flag of the United Nations, has anybody died for that?
Yes.
Who?
It's all been in the newspapers.
Washington, July 2nd. Following is the first casualty list of the Korean fighting issued by the U.S. Army. The list consists of 11 officers and men missing following the crash of a transport plane. As is the custom, names of casualties were not made public until their next of kin were notified.
London, July 10th. First British casualties. Six die when shell hits cruiser Jamaica during attack on North Korean shore. Six men were killed and three wounded, the first British casualties in the Korean conflict, by a shell from a North Korean shore battery.
But you can go further back than that, to Palestine in 1948.
Tel Aviv, Israel, September the 17th. Count Volker Bernadotte, the United Nations mediator for Palestine, with another United Nations official detached from the French Air Force, were assassinated this afternoon in Jerusalem.
Besides the mediator, Count Volker Bernadotte, 13 men died under the United Nations flag in Palestine and Greece. But unlike the men who follow them in Korea, they were unarmed save for their UN armband. One of them was a UN guard, Ole Bakke, a Norwegian who, like his fellow guards, volunteered for service in Palestine. Here is George Hendricks, Bakke's best friend, describing how Bakke was killed, transporting food and replacements in the Jerusalem area.
We went up to an observation post atop of the Hadassah Hospital itself.
Yes.
And we peered from behind sandbag lookout and watched the progress of the convoy coming up the road, even to the very point where the firing broke out. And at this point, Bucky turned and raised his hand. He stopped the jeep and raised his hand as though waving toward the direction of the fire to cease fire, and nevertheless it seemed to no avail. There was a second round of fire, and when the jeep came up, then we realized it was nothing that could be done.
Paying tribute to Count Bernadotte, Ralph Bunch, acting mediator, said,
"If there can be honor in death, Folke Bernadotte is honored. If there is glory in death, he is glorified. In the annals of peacemaking, he is immortal."
This was said about one of the first men to die for the United Nations. It can be said of those who follow him, in fighting not for one country, but for humanity. The flag which Count Bernadotte took with him to Palestine is now in General MacArthur's hands.
Well, I think you've proved your point about the UN flag. It is consecrated. Men have died for the ideals it symbolizes. But look, a flag isn't just something you're prepared to die for. It should represent something to live and work for. When we fight under the UN's flag, exactly what kind of package are we buying? What I'd like to do is take a closer look at the United Nations to refresh my memory about its aims, on how it works and what it's already achieved, the kind of thing it does.
Good enough. Let's take it right back to the beginning. 5 years ago, that was the year, April 1945. That was when they called the meeting. The war was still on, but they came by plane, ship, and train from every corner of the earth to San Francisco. The chairman, at the opening of the conference, was United States Secretary of State Edward Stettinius.
The Conference of the United Nations on International Organization is now convened.
Item number one on the agenda was a question millions of people were asking. Asking in the ghetto of Warsaw, asking in the living tomb of Belsen, asking in the soggy jungle of Burma. A question being asked by millions of people who were fed up with war. What was it all for? The President of the United States gave this answer.
The essence of our problem here is to provide sensible machinery for the settlement of disputes among nations. Without this, peace cannot exist. We can no longer permit any nation or group of nations to attempt to settle their arguments with bombs and bayonets. If we do not want to die together in war, we must learn to live together in peace.
And the 50 nations present, which later grew to 59, drew up a charter. Here's the opening of the charter.
We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, and to unite our strength.
So reads the preamble to the Charter. Then follow the 70 articles of the Charter itself, including
Article 7. There are established as the principal organs of the United Nations a General Assembly, a Security Council, an Economic and Social Council, a Trusteeship Council, an International Court of Justice.
Wait a minute. Can we take those one at a time?
Sure. Where would you like to start?
Let's hear it again. Slowly, please.
There are established as the principal organs of the United Nations a General Assembly.
That's enough. Let's hear some more about the General Assembly.
All right. Let's jump forward a few years to the General Assembly of April of last year. Here's a UN commentator at the opening.
I'm speaking to you from the floor of the Great Hall at Flushing Meadows, New York. There's an air of excitement here now, because in just a few minutes, the 58 members of the United Nations General Assembly will be called to order by their president, Herbert V. Evatt of Australia. As a matter of fact, Mr. Evatt is sitting right now on the high, dark walnut bench in front of the hall. To his right is the Secretary General of the United Nations, Trygve Lie. Behind them, a sort of backdrop dominates the entire hall. Now floodlights are playing on it. A huge map of the world that symbolizes this World Assembly makes you feel as though you were far above the earth looking down upon the North Pole. The photographers have been having a field day. A moment ago, Russia's Andrei Gromyko and Dean Acheson of the United States shook hands, and of course all the photographers cluttered around them. Now Mr. Acheson has stopped to talk with Ernest Bevin of the United Kingdom. But just now Mr. Everett has whispered something to Mr. Lee. He's taken up his gavel in his right hand, and I believe in a moment the opening meeting of the United Nations General Assembly will be called to order.
I call the General Assembly to order for the opening of the second part of its third session.
And what does Mr. Everett think of the General Assembly?
I say that this assembly is emerging, gentlemen, strongly as a parliament of the peace-loving nations of the world. Indeed, it's a mirror of the world in which we live. I'd like to quote words that were used at the end of the first part of the session by myself as president. Almost every great problem with which the world is faced today has been placed in one form or another before this General Assembly of the United Nations. In the result, this will be fortunate for the peoples of the world. I adhere to that opinion. I believe it's being proved true. And I think it's also true to say that the United Nations has demonstrated once again that it is the most powerful influence for peace in the world today.
And what happens at the General Assembly meetings? What sort of things do they deal with?
Any subject within the scope of the UN Charter can be brought before the General Assembly. And that means every aspect of international political, social, economic, legal, and cultural affairs. Each member country has one vote. And on most matters, a simple majority carries the day. But on important matters, a two-thirds vote is needed. There is no veto in the General Assembly.
Now look, I've heard a lot of complaints about the UN that it has no real teeth in it. Supposing a minority loses the vote, does it have to abide by the majority decision?
Well, the General Assembly's decisions are in the form of recommendations to the member governments, because you have to remember that it's a gathering of sovereign states.
Well, then it can't really tell one of the big boys how to act.
But it exercises moral power, which even the big boys do not dare defy for very long. There's one important exception to the Assembly's power to make recommendations. It can't make a recommendation on a dispute involving peace or security when the Security Council is at work on it. The maintenance of peace and security is the special responsibility of the Security Council.
It is, huh? Then it's the Security Council I want to know about right now. It's got the responsibility for looking after things like the Korean crisis, has it?
That's right.
Well, let's have it.
Well, shall we go back to the charter for a moment?
Okay, but not too many whereases and accordinglys, please.
Article 23. The Security Council shall consist of 11 members of the United Nations, the Republic of China, France, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and the United States of America shall be permanent members of the Security Council. The General Assembly shall elect 6 other members of the United Nations to be non-permanent members of the Security Council.
And what is the special job of the Council?
To maintain international peace and security.
Forgive me if I sound cynical, but doesn't that seem a bit, well, academic right now?
Think so? We're in the middle of a sharp local conflict, which could, let's admit, develop into a world conflict. It hasn't yet, and pray God it never will. But don't forget that there have been, in the short history of the UN, several international disputes which could easily have spread into world conflicts, but for the United Nations. And that's the main job of the Security Council. At first, it mediates and exercises its good offices to bring the parties to a dispute to a pacific settlement. If that fails, it can apply coercive measures such as it's doing now in Korea.
Yes, but let's be realistic now. Has mediation ever really worked?
Yes, it has. Remember the Palestine question? Here's Colonel Frank Bigley, a member of the mission, in an interview recorded at the time.
To me, the greatest satisfaction came from the demilitarization of Mount Scopus. This job required the saving of a cultural facility, which, as you know, includes Hadassah Hospital, Hebrew University, the Augusta Victoria Hospice, and the Arab village of Issawiya.
Well, how long did it take you to get a successful agreement on this?
Through force of circumstances, it was necessary to do the whole job in one day because the truce was fading out and hostilities were being resumed.
Well, how did you go about handling it?
Well, it was necessary to keep shuttling back and forth between both commanders, reducing their areas of difference. When we found that we could reduce it to writing, I took a typewriter in the back of a car and drafted the terms of agreement on a single sheet of paper.
You did this all yourself?
Yes, there was no other help available.
Were you ever shot at in the course of arranging for these truces, local truces?
We were always shot at. In general, the United Nations flag commanded respect, but you have so many trigger-happy elements on both sides that you're always exposed.
Such men as these helped to bring peace to Palestine, the peace which Ralph Bunche, Count Bernadotte's successor, spoke of in his address to the Jewish and Arab delegations at the signing of the armistice. It was received here at UN by shortwave.
In affixing your signatures here today to this general armistice agreement, you have ensured the return of peace to Palestine. You have used pens, not swords. You have applied reason, not force. And you have reached agreement.
That was an example of mediation, initiated and carried through by the Security Council and its agencies. The same process was applied in Indonesia, in Kashmir, and with success.
Yes, but you've got a tougher nut to crack now. What if the parties to the dispute, or even one party, won't accept mediation? What actual power has the Security Council got to make them toe the line?
Quite a lot. More than any international body has ever had before.
Maybe that's small comfort. What can it do? I may be wrong, but the United Nations hasn't got any forces of its own, has it?
No, and I'll tell you why. And this is where I take a deep breath. Can you stand another slab of the UN Charter?
If you keep it short.
There shall be established a military staff committee to advise and assist the Security Council on all questions relating to the Security Council's military requirements for the maintenance of international peace and security, the employment and command of forces placed at its disposal.
Okay, that'll do. Now, what did this military staff committee do?
It tried to answer the question, how large an army does it take to police the world? And where should the various units come from?
What do you mean it tried?
Well, the U.S. and some of the other powers thought that each of the big five should contribute what it could most easily supply. The Soviet Union said that each of the five big powers should contribute the same number of men, ships, planes, and so on, what they called a balanced force. The situation has been stalemated since 1947.
And that's why the Korean War caught the UN without any forces to stop aggression?
Not exactly. Under the terms of the Charter, the Security Council was able to recommend action to its member nations.
You mean recommend that they use their own armed forces?
That's right. And here's the way it worked. The North Koreans attacked at 4 in the morning on Sunday, June the 25th, Korean time. Before 24 hours had elapsed, the Security Council met at Lake Success. After the Secretary General, Mr. Lee, had submitted the cabled report of the United Nations Commission in Korea, Mr. Gross, the United States delegate, said,
"A full-scale attack is now going forward in Korea. It is an invasion upon a state which the United Nations itself, by action of its General Assembly, has brought into being. It is armed aggression against a government elected under United Nations supervision. Such an attack strikes at the fundamental purposes of the United Nations Charter. Such an attack openly defies the interest and authority of the United Nations."
A draft resolution was then put forward calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities and calling on the North Korean authorities to withdraw their armed forces to the border along the 38th parallel. Speaker after speaker approved the resolution. Great Britain.
"It seems to me, Mr. President, that it is obviously right and indeed essential that the Council should lose no time in devoting its attention to this grave matter."
France, in the official interpretation.
"The delegation of France feels, therefore, that it is incumbent on the Security Council to take decisions on this matter without delay."
Cuba, in the official interpretation.
"The delegation of Cuba, being aware of its responsibilities as a member of this Security Council, wishes to support the draft resolution submitted by the United States."
The resolution was put to the vote and adopted by 9 votes to none, Yugoslavia only abstaining. The United Nations' 59 sovereign states, speaking through their chosen instrument, the Security Council, had agreed almost unanimously on the action to be taken.
Almost unanimously? Now, wait a minute. What about the Soviet Union? If the Soviet delegate had been present, wouldn't he have had the right to veto the whole proceedings?
That's true.
Doesn't that make the resolutions illegal from their point of view?
From their point of view, yes. When a second resolution was adopted calling for actual assistance to South Korea, Mr. Gromyko, the Soviet Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs, sent this message to the Secretary General.
The Soviet government notes that this resolution was adopted by 6 votes, the 7th vote being that of the Kuomintang representative, who has no legal right to represent China, whereas the United Nations Charter requires that a Security Council resolution must be adopted by 7 votes. As is known, moreover, the above resolution was passed in the absence of 2 permanent members of the Security Council, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics and China, whereas under the United Nations Charter, a decision of the Security Council on an important matter can only be made with the concurring votes of all 5 permanent members of the Council. In view of the foregoing, it is quite clear that the said resolution of the Security Council on the Korean question has no legal force.
But in the Council, the French delegate, Monsieur Chauvel, gave his reply to this. He pointed out that the responsibility of the Security Council is collective and joint.
On voit mal dans ces conditions comment l'une des délégations au Conseil, parce que l'opinion exprimée au nom de son gouvernement n'est pas suivie, peut se dérober.
One hardly can see under such circumstances how one of the delegation to the Security Council can eschew the exercise of a collective and joint responsibility because the opinion expressed in the name of its government did not happen to be followed. In fact, there is a provision in Roman law, Nemo auditur suam turpitudinem allegans. Nobody can be permitted to base his argument on his own errors. The Soviet delegation, in leaving the table and the hall of the Security Council, has thereby walked out not only on the Council, but it has walked out on the Charter.